to introduce our main speaker for this evening is Mackenzie from San Diego.
Hi, everybody. My name is Mackenzie, and I'm definitely an alcoholic. Thank you so much for your lead in, Ollie. That was wonderful. I'm so happy that we've become friends. And I want to welcome all the newcomers. I can't imagine being in a newcomer and coming to such a large meeting, so I definitely give it up to you. My sobriety date is November 11, 2014, and I have a sponsor who has a sponsor. I guess I'll just start with what it was like. I started drinking when I was 13 years old, like most people. I was very young. I remember thinking it was normal, but in hindsight, we purchased those like Seabreeze wine coolers. That was the intention of what we were going to drink. And we showed up to my friend's house, and she had a bottle of Bombay Sapphire gin, and we ended up shrieking that night. So that was my first experience drinking. And I was like, doesn't everybody drink gin for their first experience? Apparently not. You know, but honestly, like when I looked back on my drinking when I was young and in high school, maybe it's because I'm an alcoholic, but I considered it fairly average for probably a young person in high school. I mean, I would sometimes drink way too much, but I never had the obsession. I didn't have the craving. I just sometimes drank too much and had a relatively normal high school life, I thought. But the reality was, is I probably could have come into this program from Al-Anon. So my lovely twin sister is sitting here tonight, and she developed the ism a little bit faster than I did. And so I spent most of high school taking care of her. And I think that's why I didn't quite get as bad as I did until later in life. I was often the sober driver. So, I mean, I would still drink, right? But, like, I wouldn't drink that much because I had to make sure my sister got home safe. And I was a really good enabler. I would take care of her. But I remember when I got sober was the first time I realized that my childhood wasn't as normal as I thought, because I was sharing my story with my sponsor and she just started crying. And I was like, why are you crying? Like, that it was normal. That's fine. She was like, I'm just so sad for you. And I was like, oh, shit. I guess it wasn't as average as I thought. Are we allowed to swear here? I'm assuming that's okay, because that's probably going to happen a lot. And the truth was, you know, my parents got divorced when I was young, which I think a lot of people deal with that. But my dad had moved to the East Coast when we were really little. And my mom just, you know, she was doing the best she could, but she was trying to find a partner. And so she spent most of her life working or trying to find a man. And what that meant is there wasn't a lot of time for the children. My brother was 5 years older, and he decided that he wasn't okay with that, and so he kind of just separated and was always off with his friends. So it was just my drunk sister and I. And we had a lot of fun, though, right? Like, considering the situation, we were never arrested. Like, we both graduated high school and went off to college. So we really didn't get in too much trouble, but I didn't get a lot of guidance. I didn't really get a this is how a lady behaves or these are the things you should do to be successful. It was more so do whatever you want, and as long as I don't get a phone call that you've screwed up, then everything's good. So then we went to Chico State. So anyone that goes there knows what I'm talking about. It's a great place for an alcoholic to go and blend in, because everyone is an alcoholic at Chico State, I'm pretty convinced. I remember, like, walking to class, and you'd walk past, like, three keggers at 8 in the morning, and you'd be like, I'll be back. My class is over in, like, an hour and a half. We'd take sparks and pour them into Red Bull, and then we'd drink that in class, and, like, you'd get the orange lips, you know, from drinking sparks in class. And that was just how college was. Like, college was a party from the day I got there till 5.5 years later when I finally graduated. And I loved it. I honestly did. Like, it was the first time I was able to, like, let loose. I still was definitely in those enabling behaviors, taking care of other people, but it was the first time I was able to do what I wanted, and I didn't feel like there was somebody watching. I just cut a little bit too loose, of course. But for me, it was always a double life. Like, I was the person that I scheduled all my classes on Tuesdays and Thursdays so I could drink every other night, and I managed to graduate the top 5% of my class. Like, I was able to do so much, but I was completely living a double life. And while I was in college, actually before I was in college, it started with the first boyfriend I had in high school. I also started getting in very unhealthy codependent relationships. So the first relationship I had, I was 17. And he was definitely over 21 because I loved that he could buy me booze. And I remember, like, he just didn't want to even, like, publicly acknowledge me. You know, it was like, you'll be my girlfriend off behind the scenes, but in front of other people, you're just somebody I know. And nowadays, that would be completely unacceptable with me. But then I was so desperate for now what I know, you know, having my brother and dad and people leave, I was so desperate for that male affection that I put up with it, right? I put myself in a position to be hurt for the possibility of love and affection from another person. And that relationship ended with probably was one of my most embarrassing drunk moments, which is that I was almost completely blacked out drunk. I wish I'd been blacked out drunk. And we were in his truck in front of a house, and he was breaking up with me. And I was, like, hysterically sobbing. You know when you've got, like, the snot running down your nose? Like, hysterically sobbing. And he was like, okay, I'll just spend the night. Like, I'm kind of worried about you getting home safely. So we opened the front door, and it turns out there was a party, and they turned on the music, and all the windows were open, and everybody had been listening to this breakup sob. And so it was just, I mean, it was mortifying, right? So at some point in the night, I get up, I left. I was just like, I can't even face these people in the morning. And so then, you know, I'm off in college, and yet again, I get in another really sick codependent relationship. And unfortunately, because of this, I didn't have a lot of relationships with women. Like, I was friends with you if the guy I was dating was busy doing something else. And I was friends with you until I was ready to leave the party with another guy. Like, I just didn't ever form connections with women. And I'm happy to say that when you stay sober for a while, you're able to form those connections. You know, I've got some wonderful friends here tonight that are joining me just in the most amazing experiences of my life today. But that was not the situation that I had before. So we finally are, I say we a lot because I'm really codependent, as you can tell. Most of my story involves a lot of my sister. I actually joked before, I was like, they're going to hear our story tonight. So graduate college, and she goes off to rehab. And like I said, I had been so busy taking care of her, of other men, that at this point it was like, okay, now I can really cut loose. And my family was so consumed with my sister that I could do whatever I wanted and nobody noticed. And that was the truth. You know, they were so worried about her treatment and her recovery. And is she going to relapse? Is she going to stay in rehab? It was just always about her. So I was able to kind of float off into the distance. And they go, you know, here's this daughter that graduated top 5% of her class. Obviously, she's fine. You go do your thing. We're going to focus over here. Unfortunately, I got a job, too, that I moved down to Ventura County, and I didn't know anybody. And I decided at this point I was going to kind of, like, so I decided I was going to reinvent myself, right? So my idea of sobriety was I only drink wine, and then I drink NyQuil to go to bed. So that was, like, I was taking care of myself, right? And I was going to join a country club, and I was going to learn how to golf, because that's where all the good men were. They were all golfers. Like, that's where you go. So that's what I was going to do. So I go down to Ventura, and the problem is I knew nobody. It was a job where I worked from home. And so I started becoming obsessive about my weight and my body, right? So I started working out obsessively. So I was at the gym all the time. And I met a guy at the gym. And he was this, like, Puerto Rican with green eyes. And he was an ex-gangster. And he had a tattoo on his neck that was his ex-girlfriend's name with lips, but he got Void tattooed over it, so that made it a lot better. And I remember I was like, well, I'm really bored, so I'll just spend some time with this guy, not that I'll ever date him. And like 3.5 years later, maybe 4, I was like, oh shit, I ended up dating this guy. And he was such a great distraction, though. I was so bored. Like, I couldn't stand not having fun. And so, unfortunately, at this place is when, I mean, I don't know how old I was, but I was like supposed to be, you know, going into my adult career, and I'm still taking like beer bongs on the porch at like 8 in the morning. And I remember the house I was in had that like textured wall, and there were stairs going up, and I used to wake up with scrapes on my arm because I'd be so drunk I'd be like scraping my way up the wall to get home. And so at this point, other substances started coming in my life too. So I was starting to dabble in other things as well. And it became clear pretty soon that that meant I was going to be getting fired pretty soon, right? And so I decided that they were just judgmental and they were not good people. And I was going to move on to a different job anyways because I hate this job. So I was really good at doing that. I left jobs like right before I got written up or fired. And so I've actually never been written up in my entire career. But like I've really almost been fired a lot of times. And so I leave that job. And I moved to San Diego. So thankfully, that relationship, you know, we say nothing, things always happen for a reason, right? And it brought me to San Diego. And unfortunately, that turned into probably what I'd say 4 years of, I can't say, it wasn't my bottom because it didn't get me sober, but it was the darkest time of my life for sure. Because now I moved on yet again to a new place where I didn't know anybody. And it turns out after about a year, I found out that he was actually very abusive as well, which I didn't know, right? Put on all that gangster charm at first. And then, you know, now here I am and I'm trapped, right? That's how I felt. I'm living with somebody. I know nobody. I can't call my parents and tell them what I've done and what's happened because that would just be so shameful. And I remember, too, the first job I was going to get down here in San Diego. So I'd moved down here, and all I had to do was go in and sign the paperwork and pass the drug test. So obviously, I'm like, okay, I've got to cleanse my system. So I cleanse my system. I come in. I do the test. And, of course, as soon as I do so the night before I do the test, I drink. And I actually thought that it was just a drug test. I did not know that they test for drugs and alcohol. So that's an embarrassing truth, but it's true. So I went in drunk to my drug and alcohol screening because I went in early enough. I went in at like 7 a.m. right when they opened because I wanted to use drugs that night. And so I was like, okay, I'll go in early enough that I can pass this and then go out. So I go in, and of course, a week later, they call me in, and they go, you know, we're sorry to tell you, the job's not yours, you didn't pass your screening, you had alcohol in your system. And I was like, no, it's okay, I'm 21. And they're like, well, you actually can't come drunk to your drug screening. So it turns out that, so now I'm beside myself, and now I'm just drinking and using, because I'm like, oh my God, my life's falling apart, right? So I made up some story and lied to my dad about what had happened. I said that I'd been celebrating like a baby shower and had one glass of champagne and blah, blah, blah. And it turns out he somehow had a connection with that job and called and got me a second screening. Mind you, I've now been getting messed up for like 5 days and now I've got another drug screen. So through doing like spin classes with like trash bags and drinking charcoal, whatever, like I somehow pass this test and get my job. And I'm like, whew, like, oh my God, that would have been so embarrassing, right? And like, these are the things that are happening and I have no recollection that maybe what I'm doing is abnormal behavior. It's just what I'm doing. And I'm not getting caught, right? I'm not having any repercussions at this time. I haven't been arrested. I haven't had... It's just like I'm somehow getting away with things over and over. So in my mind, it never crosses me that like there's something wrong with this. So, you know, I'm in San Diego now. I've got this job. And like I said, it turned into a very abusive relationship. And it turned into a very controlling relationship in which I really didn't... I didn't go out without him. I wasn't allowed to, essentially. You know, it was one of those things that if I did, there was such an argument that I just decided not to go. It was easier just to stay home. And, you know, God, I remember one time we got in this fight, and he tried to kill himself with a shoestring around his neck. He was like, I'm going to choke myself to death. And so I took a... I took a bottle of pills and was like, I'm going to show you how selfish it is when you try to kill yourself. Like, you know how they say we take the poison hoping someone else will die? I literally was like, and this is how selfish you are when you do that. And so I took a bottle of pills and like immediately I'm like, oh my God, I don't want to die. So I'm like throwing up this like paste. It was just, and then we never talked about it again. It was like one of those things that was really awkward. So that never happened. And we just never, so he had like, probably had like little shoelace marks on his neck. And that was just like, that was the relationship I was in. And you know what, though? The thing that was really challenging is, like, this stuff's happening. And like I said, my family is still so consumed that, like, they don't see it. And I remember one time going down, and he had choked me the night before. And I remember it hurt to swallow. And I remember my dad is sitting there, and he just keeps saying, I'm really worried about your sister. And I share that just because you have no idea the impact that we have, or that this disease has. And, you know, it's a family disease. And so check in with your loved ones. Like, you don't know. If they're falling off the face of the earth and they're dating really bad people that you're like, maybe there's a sign about that, or there's these warning signs, talk to them. You don't have to tell them, like, you know, you don't have to preach to them, but just talk to them and say, hey, are you okay? Because it's really challenging when you're kind of held up. Like, I was held up to this point of, like, you're the one that's not screwing up, right? You're the one that's not messing up. You're the good one. And I wanted to wear that persona so badly that I refused to let them see it. And it was really easy since I was here and they were there. And so I still sometimes struggle because my family sometimes still doesn't understand. Well, my sister does, but a lot of my family members still don't understand why I'm sober. They never saw it. Like, I hid it so well from them that they just still are like, really, you're never going to drink again? Like, I never saw it as a problem for you. And we always just go, I'm like, it's a problem. Just believe. Like, even if you don't agree, just know it's a problem. And so I ended up leaving that relationship. By the way, I'm going to take my watch off so I can keep an eye on the time. I ended up leaving that relationship. And he had said, if you leave, I remember he got really calm, which was never normal. He got really calm. And when I said it was over, and he left, and he sent me a text message that said, you know, if you leave, I'm going to find you and I'm going to kill you and your family. And I just knew right then I had to get out. And so I did. I packed up like one or two suitcases. I had a dog at the time, my laptop, and I left. And I moved in with my sister for a short time until we realized that wasn't a great idea. And that started like a year of isolation drinking. And so at that point, I thought that he was gone. I thought it was the boyfriend. I thought it was that experience. He was the problem. I didn't have any connection anymore to get other illegal substances. So I just basically for a year sat in my apartment by myself and drank all the time. And at some point, I realized financially it would be smarter to get a roommate. So that's when I moved in with my sister. And you know, that saved my life because she'd been sober. And she wasn't at the time, but she'd gone through the program. And, you know, we drank together for a while. And even as roommates, apparently we found out when we were sober that we both used to sit in the other, we were in our bedrooms and we were both hiding bottles in our luggage in different places, drinking alone in our bedrooms. And the other one was in the other room doing it. But we didn't want the other one to know. So, you know, one weekend I hit bottom. I got to the point where I was so depressed. I was so lonely. I had no relationships with women, no relationships with men. I didn't have anybody in my life. And I was just drinking vodka, just chugging it. I'd wake up, drink. And I can't even tell you if the TV was on. I honestly was just, I didn't care. And I knew I was supposed to go to work and just never called in. Like, I just never showed up, never called. I was managing a clinic at the time with, like, 30 direct reports. I mean, I had a real job and didn't show up. And I went in, and they basically said, the only way you can save your butt is to do, like, some kind of stress leave, right? So I said I was so stressed. And my sister said, I think you have a problem and I think you need a meeting. And she brought me to my first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous that night. And, you know, I've got a little over 4 years. I've never had a drink since that first meeting. And I was the crier. I was the crier for my first year, probably. So I'm really surprised I've only teared up once so far. And, you know, I didn't know a lot about the program, but what I knew is that I didn't even know I was an alcoholic. I just knew I was desperate for a change. And I was willing to go. I was willing to go to my first meeting. And she dropped me off, and then she was like, bye, I'm going to go drink for a little bit longer. And so I remember from her being sober before, she went to meetings and she had a sponsor. I knew those two things existed. So that's what I did. I went to meetings, and that 30 days I was off from work, I went to probably at least two meetings a day. I went to a ton of meetings, and I immediately got a sponsor, and I immediately jumped into service, because I must have heard at one of the first meetings I was at someone say that, like, service keeps you sober. And I was like, okay, like, for whatever reason, I just had the gift of desperation enough that I did anything people suggested. I was like, I will do that. What do I need to do? And my first commitment was going to a meeting up in North County, and it turns out it was where it was called Bringle Terrace. I don't know if anyone's been there. It's where all the people that get out of prison go. And it's a huge meeting. And I used to go, and I was the cookie girl. So I'd bring all the guys cookies. And at one point, they kept asking me to sponsor them. And so I remember, like, I called them my uncles, because it was this older group of guys. I was still really uncomfortable around women. And they were like, I think they knew that if I didn't get kind of, like, protected, that I was going to get in with the wrong guys, and they were never inappropriate. They were the most respectful, kind, loving men, and they really took me underneath their wing, and, like, I think they kept me away from the predators, honestly. Like, I think that I just needed them, and they brought me to this meeting, and they would be like, no, she can't sponsor you, you know, and they'd, like, keep me away from these guys. And I got a sponsor, and I immediately jumped into the steps, and, you know, the first step took me a really long time. I remember I'm really competitive, and I was seeing all the people that came in my class, and they were like on the fifth step when they took their 90 days, and I was still in the first, and I was pissed off. I was like, sponsor, you need to get me through this faster. And it's because I just really had a hard time admitting that I could never drink again. I had a hard time seeing that I wasn't able to stop on my own. Because in my mind, like, relapse was what proved that. That's what I thought. I thought, how do I know? I've never tried to stop before. This is the first time I'm trying to stop. So how do I know I can't drink again? That was what I thought. And what my sponsor had to keep reminding me from doing my first step work was, I tried to stop all the time. I tried to limit what I was doing. I tried to not drink during the weekdays. I tried to not drink when I woke up. I tried to not drink certain kinds of alcohol, you know, just beer and wine, not vodka. And, like, five bottles of wine is probably the same as a bottle of vodka, you know? And, like, I had tried to stop and control my drinking. I mean, I watered down my own vodka. Like, like, that's weird, right? And I did all these things, and, like, she had to show me, like, that was what you did to try to stop. Like, you don't have to relapse to prove to yourself that you're an alcoholic. That doesn't have to be your story. So then I get into 2 and 3, and, you know, finding a higher power wasn't, or the idea of God wasn't necessarily challenging for me, because I'd never grown up with a God. I'd never gone to church, so I didn't have that whole experience or negative experience with it. I just didn't know what it was. Like, the idea of turning my will over and something else will do something for me if I do nothing, I was like, that doesn't make sense to me. But I tried, and I talked to God. That's kind of my prayer. You know, I don't do any formal praying. I have conversations with my God. And I remember, like, somebody said in one of the early meetings I went to, she said, I just remember one day the light came back on, and I was like, that's what I want. Like, I just, at first, it was so dark. I honestly felt like the world, like a blanket had gone over, and everything was black and white. Like, it was just, I was so dead inside. And one day, I'm just driving down the freeway, and I see, like, you know when the sun goes through the clouds, and it's got, like, the lines coming down, and I just started crying, and I realized, like, I was feeling joy again. I was just like, oh my God, like, it's working. Something in here is working. And when it came to my fourth step, I was actually one of those weird people that I was eager to do it. And I was eager to do it because I was so eager for the relief. Like, I needed the relief. I hated where I was. And so I started doing my fourth step. I went to get my oil changed at Jiffy Lube, and I'm like, oh, perfect time. I've got, like, 45 minutes. I'll sit down and start writing. And, of course, I immediately start, like, sobbing. And the guy in Jiffy Lube's like, are you okay, ma'am? You know, he's probably like, we'll be quick with your car. Like, and I was like, I'm fine. You know, and I go aside, and I call my sponsor. She's like, oh, my God, go home and write this. She's like, please do not write it at Jiffy Lube. So I write this, and I honestly, I mean, if I counted it, I probably had like almost 100 pages. I remember like the look on her face as she's like, oh shit, you're one of those sponsees. Like, this is going to take a while. So we didn't do like one block. We did session after session after session. Like, and I went to like a big book study. I hopped into a big book study in my first couple of months of sobriety, and we'd meet for like an hour or two before the big book study to do my four step and go to that. And like, I just kept plugging away at it. And what I can say I learned after my fourth step was it was the first time I was able to be like, all right, like, that was my life. Like, I was such a liar. I was always the person that said, I'll behave how you want me to behave. I'll think how you want me to think. I was totally a people pleaser. So, you know, anything I could do to make you smile, make you laugh, make you happy. If you were happy, then I was happy. That's how I judged my joy. If you were successful, then I was successful. And so when I had my fourth step, it was the first time I was like, that's me. Like, that's my life. These are the experiences I've had, and this is who I am and my part in things. And I didn't have this, like, huge relief. I just had this, like, all right, like, it was just like, that's okay. It's okay that these things happened, and now I see what I need to focus on. And when I have sponsees do their fourth step, the first thing I always have them do is write down, I used to say 20, and honestly, I say like 20 to 50 things that you love about yourself. And if you can't think of them, ask other people around you that care about you. Because the truth is when all was said and done, here's this list of like 20 to 50 things I love about myself. And here's this list of like, you know, maybe like 10 common things that are like corroding threads that are showing up over and over and over in my life. And I was able to be like, I can do that, you know, like, that's okay. These things are okay. And so then we go on to, you know, 6 and 7, we go on to character defects. And again, like, I had that list now. I had these things. And I remember the first sponsor I had, it was really easy because she just said, pick one off the list and pray that God removes that. I was like, oh, that's easy. I'll do that. So I'd pick one. I'd be like, please remove my jealousy today. And like, that was the way I did it. And thankfully, I've had another sponsor since then that walked me through in a much deeper way. And what she had me do is she had me take all my character defects and look at them. And I'd have to write, what's my sad story? What's the sad story that I'm telling myself here? So jealousy, really what the sad story is I'm not good enough. Other people are better than me. I'm going to end up alone, right? That's the story I'm telling myself. And next to it, I have to write God's truth. So think, what's maybe true? What's maybe true is that I am perfect, perfectly unique just the way I am, as is every other human on this planet, right? And then, in order to have that defect of character removed, I have to take some action, right? And so what it is whenever that defect of character cropped up, I would think, okay, if I believed God's truth, how would I behave in this situation? And I behave that way. And eventually, she said, you'll find you just start to behave that way. And you know what? It's actually pretty true. I find nowadays, like most of the time, that's actually more my go-to behavior. So now jealousy is something that pops up sporadically. It's not this all-the-time thing. Every once in a while, I'm like, oh, there it is. But like, usually my go-to is to have a different behavior and to think kind, loving thoughts of other people and to be curious. Curiosity is something that's a very big value of mine. Like, I'm so curious what that perspective is, or you know, whatever it may be, like, I just try to look at things in a different way. So then we get to amends, right? And unfortunately, the embarrassing thing about a lot of my amends is it turns out I was really resentful at people that really didn't remember who I was or care. Like, so I'm going to make amends, and they're like, you know, honestly, like, I really don't remember that happening. So thanks for the apology. I'm like, oh my God, this is so embarrassing. Because I had built up these stories for so long that I was so resentful at that people really just didn't even care about. And even my first amends, it was funny, since I didn't know how to start, I remember my sponsor said, pray that God show you who the first person you need to make amends to is. So I pray, and that day I had to go to MAC, I had to get some makeup, and I walk in, and one of my ex-boyfriends, it was his cousin, is the girl at the MAC counter. And I'm like, oh my God, and she's on my list. So I start to make amends to her, and it's really awkward, and, you know, by the end of it, I'm feeling great, and I get to my car, and, like, I think out of, like, sheer vindication, like, she just, she had piled on makeup on my face so thick that when I smiled, you could see, like, creases. And I was like, touche, okay, you got me back. And, you know, from then, I just started going through the list, right? Like, and we made the list in three parts. It was the people I'm ready to make amends to now, the people that I will do someday, and then the fuck no never list, right? And she said, just start with the people you can do now, and then when you feel like you've got your bearings on that, go into the next list and start, you know, making those amends to the someday, and eventually you'll be able to get to those fuck no nevers. And she was right. And I remember one of my hardest amends, I went down and made amends to my dad and stepmom, and still at this point, my family is having a hard time wrapping their head around why I'm sober. They still don't quite understand it. And so, you know, they ask questions, and I had to be mindful about what I said so I didn't cause more harm, because some of my stories, while we think are funny, like my dad probably wouldn't think was that funny. But I had to be honest, and I told them, look, like, I was drinking around the clock, and I was going to get fired and lose my job, and I had to be honest about a lot of these things. And I remember when I was making amends to my stepmom, I had to make amends for the damage I did in her marriage, because at first I didn't realize, like, what harm I caused her. But I realized that by me not being present, by me withdrawing the way I did and not coming to family events and not being around people because I didn't want them to see my drinking, it caused them a lot of worry and it caused them a lot of arguments. You know, they fought a lot because my dad was so concerned, and she just, they get in arguments. She'd say, you know, they're adults, let them do what they, whatever their arguments were, I don't know, but like I had to make amends for that. And I know, Ollie, you talked about time, stealing time from people. Like, it was so challenging when I made my amends to my dad. One of the things he said is, he said, I thought you just hated us because I wasn't coming around. And that wasn't the case. I just loved them so much that I was too embarrassed to let them see what was going on. And, you know, you get through the amends. Like, there's still some I have to make. I was really grateful when I went to make a financial amends to a place I stole from and closed down. I was like, oh, credit. Like, because I had sticky fingers. I like to steal a lot. I had the perfect system from stealing from Vons. It was just so, anyways, I stole a lot. I still actually owe that Vons financial amends. So it's on the list, though. It's one of the fuck knows never, just so I'm, like, super scared to do it. But I will do it. And then, you know, we get to 10 and 11, and it's like, you know, you continue to take, you know, inventory, and then we do prayer and meditation. And so I used to do a little bit more formal reading. Is it like 84 through 87 or whatever? I used to read those a little bit more regularly and do inventory at the end of every day, a formal one with, like, friends. I'd send a message and do an inventory. But now it's like an all-day thing, honestly. Like, I'm just constantly checking in with myself. You know, was I just honest by exaggeration? I'm a storyteller, and so I, when I'm talking, sometimes I can exaggerate, and I have to check in and be like, was that honest? And if it's not, sometimes I say, hey, you know what? I just totally lied to you. That did not happen. And my friends, I'm sure, think it's funny because they're like, oh, Mackenzie. Other people are like, who says that? Like, who immediately says that they just lied to my face? And then, yeah, right? And then meditation, I try to meditate every single day. I suffer from really bad anxiety, and I used to abuse Xanax. And so when I got sober, one of the things is the doctor that wrote me that note to take me off work for 30 days said that the only way he'd do it is if I went to AA and if I stopped taking my Xanax. So, you know, he cut me off, and thank God for that doctor. And then, you know, meditation has really helped me. It hasn't relieved it, but it's really helped with my anxiety. I do breath work, so even just the idea of, like, you know, you breathe in and you kind of, like, feel the breath in, and then when you let it go, you let your shoulders drop. Like, just this kind of breathing exercises that really have been able to help me. And then we get to step 12, and I remember the first time I sponsored, I was terrified. I was like, I don't know what to do, and they're like, you just do what I just walked you through, right? And I started sponsoring. I went to, I didn't have any sponsees, so I went down to, what's Dawn Patrol in PB, which is like a lot of newcomers. They bust them in from the sobriety houses. So I remember I stood up and I was like, if anybody wants a sponsor, I'm looking for sponsees. And like five girls came up to me afterwards, and I was like, oh shit. And of course I was like sponsoring all of them. I would go down to the house and like knock them out. I would like see them all, you know what I mean? And And I remember one of them was like, oh, this girl, she, you could tell she did not want to be in treatment. And they made you have a sponsor at one of the houses she was at. And she was so combative. And she'd just be like, well, I still don't understand. And she'd keep doing it. I remember I was like almost in tears leaving that. And, you know, then eventually you realize, like, I just walked them through what I did. And if they don't receive it or it doesn't work for them, that's their thing. They get to move on and find another sponsor then, you know? I'm not here to cure anyone or fix anyone. I'm just here to walk them through the steps as I went through them. And someone explained it to me really well. They said, it's like you're in a forest. And they said, you know, when you're a newcomer, you look at this forest with all of its trees, and you're like, oh my God, where do I go? I have no idea where to go. And so the sponsor is the guide that walks you through the forest, and the big book's the map. And with those two things, that's how you learn to get to the other side, right? Like, that's how you get through the forest. And so I just walked them through it as I did it. And it's been an absolutely amazing experience. And I, you know, just like people say, when you sponsor, it seems like you get more out of it than the sponsee does. And I've got 4 sponsees right now, and I'm so grateful for every single one of them, and they're all totally different. And it doesn't mean there's not days that I'm so tired after work, and I get home, and I'm like, oh, I just want to go to bed. But I swear to God, the second they come over, I'm like, oh, that was such so great. Like, I'm so happy I just met with them. You know, I always feel so good. And I've had a sponsee ever since that first one I took. And I started sponsoring it my first year. So for 3.5 years, I've never not been without a sponsee. There was one brief time I was, and I immediately, like, knew I needed to get a sponsee. And, you know, now it brings me to here today in front of, I don't know how many people, a lot of people, sharing my story. And it's surreal. And it's like the job that I left when I was drinking, the one that was going to fire me. Now, like, I left the job a little bit ago to get a better job, right? It turns out I wasn't in trouble. Like, I was actually doing really well, and I left to get a better job. And when I left, the CEO of that organization called me in just to say, I'm going to steal you back. Like, we're so sad you're going. We want you working here again. And I just, like, I remember I walked out of there, and I was like, holy shit. Like, sobriety is rad, you know? Like, and all I've done, and even, like, as a leader, because I led a team, often they'd say, wow, you have so much wisdom. And it would just be like sayings from AA, you know, like nothing. I remember like thinking if there's anyone that's in AA, they're going to know really fast because I use these terms that anyone in AA knows. And it's just a surreal life. Like now I've got, you know, I'm getting married as well soon. And I've got like 12 women coming to my bachelorette party, which if I got married before I got sober, it probably would have been like my sister. And, you know, it's just, and it's an absolutely wonderful relationship built on like honesty and trust. And, I couldn't be more fortunate to be with the partner that I'm with today. And, you know, the program won't necessarily give you money or jobs or relationships or any of these things, but what it's given me is the knowledge, no matter what happens, if I lose that relationship, if these friends move away and leave, if I get fired from my job, I know without a doubt I will be okay. I know I have a foundation. I know I have a place to go. I have a relationship with a higher power that protects me and loves me and cares for me. And it's such a crazy journey, and I'm just so happy to be on it and to be sober and to be here, and I think I'm at time. I think that's pretty freaking amazing that I just spoke for 45 minutes. So anyways, thank you all so much for having me.